We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. There would have been a time when few people in higher education would even consider going to court to settle a campus dispute. Today, however, things are very different. There are places where professors have sued one another for defamation. Students have sued professors when they got bad grades, and there have been professors who have threatened at least to sue students for criticizing their teaching. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about this trend and also what it means for academic freedom. And our guest for the program is Amy Guida. She is assistant professor of journalism and assistant professor of law at the University of Illinois. She does legal commentaries that air on public stations around the state. This one included. You hear them on the Morning Edition and on the Afternoon Magazine, and also they appear in a print version in our newspaper, the News Gazette. She's won 7 AP awards for her legal journalism, and she is the author of a book that just came out last fall that deals with this subject that we'll be discussing. The title of her book is The Trials of Academe, The New Era of Campus Litigation, and the book is out now. If you want to take a look at it, it's published by the Harvard University Press. And as we talk this morning, questions, comments are welcome. Now, we ask people who participate to be brief, keep their comments brief, and try to stay on the topic. But people are certainly welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we also now have an email, so if you'd like to make your comment question that way, it's will-talk@illinois.edu. So anyway, you're welcome to participate. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, sure. It's delightful to be here the second day of the term. So I thought it would be a perfect day to talk about maybe what professors should be worried about when they hand out syllabi and other things like that.
So, yeah, this far into the semester, everybody should be pretty much okay with one another, you'd think.
You would hope so,
yeah.
Except what I mean that very seriously, is one of the ways that I think the college and university classroom is changing is that courts are looking to syllabi as contracts. And so the AAUP, an association of university professors, has suggested that professors put a qualifier in their syllabus, and they suggest that the qualifier should be something like this. Syllabus is subject to change at the discretion of the professor. So that sort of – that gives you, I think, an indication of how bad it's gotten in some places, that when the AAUP suggests that we put qualifying language like that. This is not a promise. This is not a contract. We are not going to promise you what you are going to learn. We're going to give you some idea of what we're going to try to talk about this term, but you won't necessarily come away able to take some sort of national exam, like a bar examination, for example, in law.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very striking, and I'm sure that probably now universities also have to think about what it is, what kind of promises or implied promises they make in the materials that they have that they're intended to attract people to apply to that university. And I think that there even has been at least one case where someone enrolled for whatever reason, did not complete their degree, was not successful. And then that person turned around and sued the university because he said, well, look here what it says in your pamphlet. You say, I'm going to get such and such a degree. Well, I didn't, and I'm going to sue you now.
Yeah, isn't that curious that the language, as I recall, was seen by the courts as a promise. And the promise was you will take these courses, and these courses will lead to a certain degree. And the student, as I recall, was unable to complete a certain class, so was let go from the program, and the student sued. And right now it's on appeal, but the student has been marvelously successful thus far, the last time I looked at least, and we're talking millions of dollars in a jury a jury award, which again is up on appeal. What I think is really curious is that the Times of London took a look at my book a couple weeks ago and said that that was perfectly fine. Because they believe that that indeed was a promise in campus literature, and that colleges and universities should be aware of words like that. There's another really interesting example, and that is one springing from a promise within a university that all students would be treated with fairness. And a student then brought a cause of action based on that promise. Again, these are sort of ethereal promises, I think, on campus literature, but brought a lawsuit based on what he or she felt was mistreatment then at the hands of a particular professor. So so it really is interesting in contractual terms and also leading to how then professors may take a look at course coverages and promises and then universities, as you point out, as well in literature and websites urging students to come to that particular school or university.
Well, I would think here that there would be one basic sort of question that or issue that a court would have to acknowledge, and would that not be the implied and I would argue generally understood qualification that when you enroll, you're expected to be up to doing the work. And that you will actually do the work, and that if it can be argued that the student was not successful because he or she was simply not doing what was expected of them as a student, then doesn't that toss the claim out the door?
Well, I think the problem is that some courts have taken a look at that, and some courts have said, you know what, that's a decent argument, but let's leave it up to a jury. And then when a jury has to decide a question like that, there's a lot of animosity toward academia. And I think that those sorts then juries may come back with an award in the millions. Maybe an appellate court will overturn that on precisely that argument. We would hope so, at least in my opinion. But some of those cases are still out. And we also, I think, have to remember that even if a court does throw a particular case out, the problem is that the case is filed in the first place. And so when these sorts of cases are filed, what ends up happening is university counsel then across the nation get wind of a particular case and may urge faculty to do something in response to that particular case. So in other words, just because there's no jury outcome or a legal outcome in favor of, like, say, a student who sues, doesn't mean there isn't some sort of repercussion within that particular university and potentially all universities as we become more litigation conscious.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk about some other specific cases, but to take a step back, one of the points that you make here is that maybe as recently as just a couple of decades ago, these kinds of suits, they wouldn't have been filed, or if they were, they would simply be thrown out. So what has changed?
Well, I think a couple of things have changed. I mean, a couple of big things. The first is that courts got more accustomed to dealing with cases involving colleges and universities when they got involved in discrimination, civil rights lawsuits, which I think are wonderful. So I'm not arguing here that we should not have lawsuits brought against colleges and universities because, of course, they can behave badly as well. So ultimately, that's a really good thing. The second thing, so courts got more accustomed to this initially because of academic freedom concerns. They held universities and colleges at arm's length. But then these civil rights claims made them more accustomed to dealing with colleges and universities, opening the door for additional claims that may have an impact on academic freedom. I think the second thing that's changed, and you really see this a lot in, I think, in responses to the argument that colleges and universities deserve some sort of academic freedom, and that is that colleges and universities have become more and more like businesses. And courts have said this in their opinions against colleges and universities, that listen, you are behaving like a business. You are wooing customers, students, with glossy brochures. You are much more concerned with issues of rank rather than issues of instruction. And your leaders, some have argued, are becoming more businesslike and even narcissistic, some have argued. And in light of that, we're going to treat you just like we would a business. And therefore, is it our business to decide if a professor turned back exams in an appropriate way? Well, sure, because we would decide the same thing if we would decide a negligence cause of action if this were a business.
Hmm. I'm not sure how much news coverage things like this have gotten, or whether it's something that people outside of academia will think about or be aware of. But we're not talking here about just a few lawsuits. We're talking about a big issue for colleges and universities. One, for example, that I guess has gotten some attention and I've noticed in some of the things that I've read about you and about the book was University of Nevada at Reno facing more than 30 lawsuits. And they've just been dealing with a few cases, a handful of cases that have already spent a couple of million dollars on legal fees. And there are a number of cases yet that have to be dealt with.
Right. Now, I should say, interestingly, I heard from university counsel there. And interestingly, they say that there's just one particular attorney who is filing a number of these lawsuits. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's one particular attorney who's sort of gotten to the university and so is filing these causes of action. But again, that we still have to respond to them. Just because it's one or two attorneys, we still have to respond to these within universities. And I think be conscious of the way courts could be handling these sorts of claims. Again, I'm concerned, number one, that the claims are happening in the first place, some of them, I should say. And then the second of my concerns is that that courts are feeling freer to grapple with these things that I think at least touch on issues of academic freedom.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Amy Guida. She is assistant professor of journalism and assistant professor of law at the University of Illinois. She is the author of a recent book published last fall, The Trials of Academe, The New Era of Campus Litigation, published by the Harvard University Press, which looks at what is a trend we're starting to see more and more, and that is campus disputes, things that previously would have been dealt with as a campus matter, now being taken to court.
Or then even more tightly held than that, perhaps even within just a department. So so it would be resolved within a department even before it was brought to
court. So disputes, it could be between colleagues or between students and professors.
Exactly right, yeah. Yes. And so we wouldn't – and again, traditionally, you wouldn't necessarily ask courts to intervene.
Well, is it fair to say that in the past that universities have operated outside of the law, and that perhaps some involvement of courts and university affairs would be appropriate?
Yes, and I think that's again the point I want to make here is that that colleges and universities did discriminate. And they would go so far, and I use some of the older cases in my book, and it was ludicrous to say – it would be ludicrous to say that courts should not intervene in such cases when, for example, a professor showed up who was disabled and a university then made the decision to fire that professor immediately, for example, those sorts of cases. Other universities would fire entire faculties because they would be led by legislators, for example. So they would decide that entire faculties should be let go. And courts, again, would say, well, you know what? We're not going to delve there. We're not going to go there. And so because of those sorts of incidents, We had then civil rights legislation that allowed courts to intervene in areas of discrimination, and I think that's a wonderful thing. So yes, did universities behave badly? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. What I think is happening now is that there's this trend where courts are feeling freer to intervene in disputes between professors, for example, in a defamation lawsuit based on scholarly research.
Yeah. Well, there's another area in which we've seen legal action. That an example, say, one person does a particular piece of research, they write something, whatever, and it's very common for other people in the field to look at that person's work and criticize it and say, no, this person's all wet, they don't know what they're talking about, this research is flawed, and it's not good for this reason and this reason and this reason, so forth. And I think that some people would argue, in fact, that kind of critique is absolutely necessary for the whole enterprise. You know, so people have to look at each other's work and say, no, I got a problem with this, and I'll tell you why. But now apparently there have been cases where, in fact, someone whose work was criticized didn't like it, mm-hmm. and took legal action.
Right. And it's I completely agree with you that that sort of discourse moves the academic idea forward. Mm-hmm. So it broadens the scope of what people are researching. I love to have feedback on my scholarly work because I think it becomes so much better from that sort of feedback. It's interesting that you should say that colleagues should say things like your research is flawed and it's all wet. And the way courts would look at that is the courts would say in a defamation lawsuit, courts would say, well, you know, all wet is really an opinion. So that's going to be protected. You can't bring a defamation lawsuit based on opinion. If you say that someone else's research is flawed, a court could find that that is actually a defamatory statement because it's not an opinion, a court could find, and it's based on some sort of fact that you're arguing is incorrect. And so it's that flawed criticism that could get some academics in trouble. Again, this isn't. Again, I should say this isn't happening willy nilly across the United States, but it's happening enough so that I am at least conscious about the way I say things when I criticize colleagues' work.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that both of these happen. These kinds of things happen. That is, you know, I was standing around the water cooler. One person says, you know, Professor X is an idiot, should never have gotten a PhD, and isn't even qualified to sling espresso shots down at the Starbucks. But I would certainly hope, though, if someone in a more formal way was criticizing another person's research, that they would have very specific criticisms. And then would he be able to back those criticisms? It wouldn't just be ad hominem stuff.
Sure.
It would be very detailed, say, all right, this I think is wrong, and I'll tell you why, and I'll show you why I think this was not done correctly, and I'll show you what the problems here. One would hope that the criticism would be backed up in just that way. And have both of those have people taken action about both of those sorts of things?
Well, there have been threats, let's say. So there have been some threats brought by people who have been criticized, even when the person doing the criticizing has he or she believed proven the basis for the criticism. And I think the reason why is because when you think about it, in academia, there's people's reputations. Are built on their scholarly research. And so when someone criticizes that scholarly research in a way that really stings and in a way that the professor really feels is unfair, you can see why, I think, especially in today's economy and in today's situation within colleges and universities, where more and more there's more and more emphasis on what needs to be published in order to get tenure, how that reputation has to be uniformly wonderful across the United States in order to get tenure. You can see then why someone might be more concerned today about that sort of criticism of their scholarly product.
We have a caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, Professor Guida. Thanks for this important discussion. I'd like to know, given the current mandate for faculty not to go to work, whether, I guess this is two questions, whether or not the students who have essentially paid tuition are due a refund legally because the university is not providing what it contracted to provide. And secondly, it's also denying the faculty for work days that those who are working towards tenure or promotion would then be without because the university is stating that they must not work. So in both cases, is the university leaving itself open, we're talking about the University of Illinois, of course, open to lawsuits from both faculty and from students?
Well, I will say that I have not looked into this. I just got that same email this morning saying that we had the option of actually taking a particular day. So I haven't looked into it. But I will say to you that this is not the first time I've heard this sort of question from someone, meaning that response, that the concern that in fact students might think about suing, there would have to be some sort of damages proved, though, of course, and then also faculty suing for the same thing. So I think even though I haven't looked into it, so can't respond to it generally as a cause of action, I can tell you that it's not the first time I've heard that sort of response to what the university has announced.
Well, in a more general vein, it seems that universities, including the University of Illinois, are apt to act quite cavalierly, knowing that faculty do not have the resources to file a lawsuit against the University of Illinois, which has, in many legal cases, unlimited resources to spend millions of dollars fighting what may be something very obvious that the faculty rights are infringed upon.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's part of the criticism, certainly, that we hear against universities, that universities can behave almost like, again, as I said, a business and not suffer the same repercussions necessarily that traditional businesses would, and cloak everything in academic freedom. And that sort of cloak is not as effective today, let's say, as it once was. And ultimately, again, that might be a good thing in certain cases.
We're at our midpoint here. Other questions and comments are welcome. We'll continue our conversation with Amy Guida. She's an assistant professor of journalism and assistant professor of law at the University of Illinois. She does legal commentaries. You hear them on our station. They also air on other public stations around the state. She's the author of the recently published book, The Trials of Academe, The New Era of Campus Litigation. It is published by the Harvard University Press and deals with the subject here we're talking about. Other questions are certainly welcome. Again, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu.
You know, I think I want to touch on or no, I'm sorry, go on.
No, go
okay.
ahead. Okay.
What I'd like to touch on here and and what sort of brought to mind by the caller's questions is this notion about, well, then what to do? What should we do then when we sort of look toward litigation? How can we change things? And I think I think the way we can change things, part of my argument in the book, is not that judges need to stay away from this sort of these sorts of actions, but that we need to teach judges about academic life so that they can recognize when something may involve academic freedom versus when it may be a nice cut and dried business decision that doesn't really impact the way a professor teaches in class, for example. But then also more practically, I think that we need to better a sense of community on campus. So the greater sense of community there is, I think, within any organization, and I'm speaking as a lawyer here, fewer lawsuits arise from that. Also, the more outlets we have for disputes on campus, so things like buds persons within campuses can be a really good thing. In fact, I was just talking last week. I was at a conference with one of the professors who brought one of the lawsuits that I focus on in the book, and he said, "Boy, if that outlet had been there on campus, he never would have brought the lawsuit." So some people have criticized me for being incredibly naive about this idea for buds persons within on campuses. And yet, you know, anecdotally at least, there's one of these professors has said that absolutely he wouldn't have brought the lawsuit if that had been available to him. So,
well, I guess you would have to say that if we are seeing these kinds of lawsuits and if we're seeing more and more of them, that should suggest that there's something wrong with the systems for dispute resolution that already exist.
I think that's right. And I also think that some of the other reasons why this is happening is, as I said, the commercialization. And then also this sort of wariness, I believe, on campus as colleges and universities look more and more to non-tenure or tenure-track faculty to teach courses. And so these are instructors who oftentimes travel from one college to another college without any sort of job security. And in light of that, you can see then why those people may bring a lawsuit. Their jobs have no security. And if they feel that they've been promised something, why shouldn't they bring a lawsuit then to try to hold their job? And so that's why I think these economic times and this shift also toward non-tenure track faculty is also having an effect then on incidents of litigation.
Just to go back for a moment to the subject of academic freedom, this is something that people on university campuses talk about, and it's complicated, and I suppose it's not an easy thing to define. When you look at the way courts have thought about it, mm-hmm. how indeed do courts think about the idea of academic freedom? Do they even consider that such a thing exists, or with what sort of limitations do they think it exists?
Sure. Well, what I think is really interesting is that academic freedom in the court's minds springs from the First Amendment. And so academic freedom, courts have found, really is owned by three entities. One is the professor. So the professor has the academic freedom to teach a class in a particular way. So the way that professor really believes that students will learn. The second problem, or the second owner of academic freedom, is then the university. So the university has academic freedom as well to decide the way students will be taught, let's say in a broader sense, and decide for itself its vision, its goals, and that sort of thing. The third owner of academic freedom is then the students themselves. So courts have found that students have the right to learn in a classroom free from discrimination or sexual harassment, let's say. And that's what I think is really quite interesting, is when you have that conflict then between what the university wants, what a professor wants, the way a professor feels a particular class should be taught, and the way the students respond to the way that particular class is being taught. And so that's the way courts have looked at academic freedom, and they decide cases in different ways based on the facts. of a particular case.
Let's talk with another caller. Belgium, line number four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I have to propose something right off here. It seems that with there being so many lawyers in America, which is we have more lawyers than any other country combined, many of them combined, that these people find work, and sometimes some of these suits are encouraged just to find work because there are just so many lawyers to keep employed.
Well, we have some I think that's an interesting point. We have some restrictions. So as you may know, I am a lawyer, and I practiced in Washington, D.C., of course, because I also teach at the law school. I would also disagree that there are too many lawyers, of course, I would say that. We do have restrictions on what sorts of cases we can bring. So if we bring a case that's deemed frivolous by a court, for example, we can get into trouble and we can be fined a tremendous amount of money, for example, for bringing a particular lawsuit. I think that all the lawsuits I looked at have that I can recall offhand, let's say, have a basis in law. So in other words, what these attorneys are doing is representing their clients to the best of their ability, hanging their hats on a particular area of law that has yet to be explored. And so my criticism really isn't so much with these attorneys, because that's the way law moves forward as well. When attorneys file these lawsuits that were once thought, oh, my goodness, you can't go there. You can't do that. Courts will decide things differently depending on the way society is going, for example. So I don't blame the lawyers, but I do oftentimes blame the courts for not seeing the nuances in a particular cause of action. So not seeing the academic freedom concerns within a decision. And I'll just give you a really quick example. And that was one involving a professor who turned back exams by leaving them outside his office. A student, it's a very long story, but a student ended up suing him for negligent exam turnback. And a federal appellate court found that that was indeed a potential cause of action. In other words, allowed it to go to a jury. And so I think that sort of thing, we're getting dangerously close to when a court is deciding how professors can turn back exams, we're getting dangerously close to how professors can teach and should teach a certain subject in their classrooms, for example. I hope that makes sense.
Well, yes, it does, but at the same time, you're defending your profession, to be completely honest.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Right. Oh, sure.
Thank you.
Thank
Other
you.
Questions, comments, you're welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm just, with the case that you cited, I'm just assuming that the student was making the argument that this was a violation of their privacy because anybody could have come along and looked at their exam and seen what grade they got?
There have been cases brought under that sort of argument. This case was brought because the student had gotten into trouble at the university because it's a very long story, but he had argued that another student then had access to his exam and was able to change one of the exam questions that he had gotten wrong to a correct question, a correct answer, causing him to therefore go to the professor and ask for a regrade. The professor had kept a copy of his original exam and said to him, "You have here's proof that you have cheated." The professor then brought the student up on disciplinary charges, and so the student argued that ultimately it was the professor's fault for turning the exams back in the way he had, and so there was a lawsuit based basically on negligent exam turnback.
I see. Yeah. Okay. I'm sure as long as there have been teachers, students, and grades, students have been complaining about the grades that they received and made the argument that they should have gotten a higher grade than they did. Now we're seeing cases where students are actually taking this to court?
Yeah, that's right. I have not found, at least that I can think of, a successful cause of action brought on grading policies. But that's also where the syllabus comes into play. So a grading the grading policy that's outlined well in a syllabus will probably never lead to a lawsuit. So something like that could be very easily decided just within probably the professor and the student. But what's happened is in some syllabi, instructors have not clearly outlined what they mean. And one of the students, for example, who filed grade litigation really believed that his, and I want to say 90 points out of 100 was an A, but because of the curve, it wasn't. And so he was surprised to end up with, I can't remember, a B or a C on his grade report. And so brought a cause of action then against that professor. That was unsuccessful. A court threw that case out and said that it refused. It didn't want to deal with this sort of thing. It didn't want to read papers and then decide what grade would be appropriate for a particular paper, recognizing that this was not the court's area. But it still, I think, shows how bold, let's say, some students can be.
Do you just one more quick question, and then I have a caller I'm going to get to. Do you have any idea, or does anyone have any idea, how many potential lawsuits were settled? They didn't get to the point of going to trial, but they were settled because university thought, well, the easiest thing for us to do is to make this go away and to try and find some way to make this person happy so that they'll leave us alone.
Right. I have not looked into that. So my research is based so it's more qualitative than it is quantitative, because it's based on those cases that have been decided by courts mostly. So most of the cases I focus on are cases that were litigated in some way and there is a reported decision by a court in that particular case.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some other folks. Champagne, next, line one.
Hello.
Yes. Yes.
Hi. I completely agree with the litigation against the way the professor turned in the tests.
Mm-hmm.
I see some of those issues in the high school with the kids. I don't think it's right to have, you know, pass your tests to each other and grade the test, you know, when it's the teacher's responsibility to do that. I think that invades my child's privacy, and I would certainly never leave a test outside the door of an instructor in my college days.
You know,
I think that is definitely inappropriate.
It is interesting that you should bring this up, because when I walk through the halls of some of the main campus buildings, I will occasionally see papers laying out for student pickup. And of course, that's the very first thing I think about. Also teaching privacy, I recognize some of the privacy issues involved in that, as David mentioned. And I think that's what I meant when I say sort of moving things forward. Maybe something like that does need to change. And maybe ultimately, I personally can see more basis in a privacy sort of cause of action than I can in a negligent exam administration or negligent administration hand back of exams So I, in other words, I think there's a more valid privacy argument. So I agree with you to an extent, let's say.
Yes, and I agree in the privacy, but don't you think ultimately that's a lazy man's way to get a test back? I mean, where's the responsibility of the adult administering the class who we're paying money to?
Yeah, I think two things happen. I think, number one, there's just this tradition. So I remember when I was in college, which granted was a long time ago, but I remember getting exams handed back in this way. So I think there's just this tradition, like, well, it's traditional that we do this. And so TAs, for example, don't recognize it because they have gotten their exams back that way. And so there's been no trickle down yet, letting these instructors know that, you know what, this could be a dangerous way to go about things in terms of a privacy violation, for example. So a FERPA violation, although I haven't really looked into that, I should say. So I'm not sure if there are FERPA-based causes of action. There could be, and that's the Federal Privacy Act in Education. So that's what FERPA.
We're working on it.
Yeah, right. That's what FERPA stands for. But I think that so often a lot of these incidents spring from that sort of notion of tradition in the classroom. So traditionally, I was always able to teach this way. Traditionally, I was always able to hand back exams in this way, or give exams in this way, or grade in this way. And that's when then the university's academic freedom may step in to say, you know what, we don't want you to teach in this way, or hand back exams in this way. And it shows the clash, I think, in areas, even on the fringes of an academic freedom argument.
Right. Okay. But tradition to me is not an excuse.
I agree. A tradition has been, it's been.
Doctor's offices, I mean, traditionally, medical records were handled differently than they are now. So
yes,
tradition has nothing to do with me. Logic and privacy and all that, but it sounds like you're working on it, so that works for me.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. I think that that of course discrimination existed also because of tradition. So I completely agree with you. I'm just trying to figure out why we may be doing that today when at least I've recognized that there are privacy implications in that behavior.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Amy Guida. She is assistant professor of both journalism and law at the University of Illinois and is author of a book came out last fall that is titled The Trials of Academe, The New Era of Campus Litigation. It's all about the subject that we're discussing. And if you want to look at the book, it's published by the Harvard University Press. Another caller here. We'll get right to. This is someone who is in Urbana and line two.
Yes. I would say that the problem isn't only the non-tenure track academic, professors, instructors, but also it extends over into the staff where there's been a concerted effort to move from civil service to, I believe it's academic professionals, who have far fewer protections and generally less advantageous employment options, fewer vacation days and so on. But I suppose in both cases, in part, it's a matter of the underfunding of the university, putting pressures toward these movements.
Yeah, I think that that's a good point. I don't know offhand if, number one, if there's that sort of trend within this university, just
there
because
is.
I'm not familiar with it, but then also whether there's a trend like that nationally. But
I'm told there is.
Okay. And it does, I think, show you, if indeed that's right, that sort of this move away, and I'll just speak very broadly here, away from sort of union protected jobs versus non-protected jobs. If indeed that's happening, you can see that. You can certainly see why the university would be seen more and more, and by the university I mean just universities in general, more as a business, and that is then a business decision. It's a business decision to hire academic professionals, both in these sorts of administrative roles, but then also non-tenure track to teach, and why then courts would see university colleges and universities as being more like businesses when they make business decisions like that to try to keep as much money as possible.
May I say one other thing?
Mm-hmm.
I thought Professor Guida's suggestion of the ombudsman is very good, if they're truly independent. We have had some for students, and I thought they were extremely helpful from secondhand experience. the procedures at present are quasi-legal, and the administration, both in the academic and in the staff area, have all the power, and the employee instructor or staff has essentially very little, and that there would needs to be reform in this matter. Perhaps an ombudsman could be very helpful if you were truly independent.
I think that's exactly right. And there's actually been a study, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there was a study done in Australia based on that. And those that were seen as more independent then, the students trusted that more, and as did professors, more as an outlet then for any sort of problems like this, quasi-legal problems and legal problems that arose on campus. So I completely agree that if we looked at that and we went more toward sort of the newspaper ombudsperson's ideal, I think they're seen as completely cut off from the editorial board, for example, and at least I trust them to give us a really fair view of what happened in a newspaper. I think that the more we move toward that goal on campuses and universities, the better off we'll be, certainly.
Yeah. Well, you talked earlier about your feeling that one way to deal with this tendency to move cases into the courts would be to look at the sense of community or lack of community in the university. And I suppose some people would say, well, that's all well and good. The fact of the matter is that unequal power relationships are a fact of life, and not just between students and faculty, but also among faculty as well.
That's right. But I think, at least looking back at some of the historical perspectives, I get the sense that because tenure was actually a helpful. Of course, you would have helpful guidance throughout your probationary period as you move toward tenure. At a number of colleges and universities, and I'm not saying that this happens at the University of Illinois, of course, because I've been wonderfully supported myself anecdotally, but there is great competition, again, because a scholar's reputation is the most important thing. And so if there is headbutting within a particular department, for example, there can be an electric sort of distrust that arises within that department, and it's that sort of then I think relationship problem that could cause litigation to arise, whereas it wouldn't have before. Yeah.
Trying to get at least one more caller. Champagne, line one, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't hear you say one. Okay. I want to respond to what Professor Guida said about non-tenured teachers. Yes, they have a lot of trouble getting jobs, and the jobs they get, I know because I was one, the jobs they get are from 1 to 3 years, and sometimes you're not hired, you know, until a month before the term starts or maybe 2 days before. When I left, I had a visiting assistant professorship at a university, and when that 3 years was up, I applied for jobs. And the job that I was finally offered required a $6,000 salary cut from me and a demotion in rank. That was for me to have a job.
Mm-hmm.
I took it.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided at that point that I would not stay in academics, and so I left and went to civil service.
Mm-hmm. I think that story is precisely what I mean when I say that people are now turning toward litigation, because in the past it may have been that you would have been able to continue on at a particular university with full benefits, et cetera, and so when we have the university as a business deciding, or a college as a business deciding to hire more of these people, and then oftentimes mistreat them, you can then see why they would be spurred toward litigation.
Well, I didn't feel like arguing over it. I just wanted something else to do. So I was really glad that I went to civil service.
Right. You felt like you didn't want to argue about it, and you left. And other people feel like, gosh, you know, I really should argue about this, especially if they feel that they've been misled or mistreated in some way.
Well, I was only at that university for a year, and so I didn't feel like arguing with them.
I see.
Yeah. All right. So I just left.
Okay. Well, thanks for the story and the call. We're coming down to the point here. We have a minute or two left. One thing that I just think is interesting, I don't know where it is, I picked up this detail, whether it was listening to you talk about this or it was in the book, that actually there are some faculty members that are getting what amounts to academic malpractice insurance. They're actually having insurance in case they get sued?
Oh, I have that insurance. That was one of the very first things I did researching this book was I went out and I got insurance, and I am then covered in my academic pursuits. So when I speak at a conference, for example, as long as I make less than $3,000, and trust me, I make nothing, I am covered for defamation causes of action and other causes of action that may spring from my scholarly talk.
Yeah. We have maybe about a minute. It's very clear why people in academe would be concerned about these issues. For people who are not, why should they care?
I think because colleges and universities have moved the nation forward. And so that scholarly pursuits have moved this nation forward. And I'm not the first to argue this, certainly. And I think the more we recognize that that there is value in scholarship, there are professors at this university, for example, doing amazingly wonderful work that will move this nation forward. And the more concerned they are about litigation, the less likely they are to sort of push the envelope of scholarship and research, let's say. And I think we'll all then feel those effects.
The guest this morning in this hour of Focus, Amy Gaida. She is assistant professor of journalism and assistant professor of law at University of Illinois. Her book is The Trials of Academe, The New Era of Campus Litigation, published by the Harvard University Press. If you're going to look for the book, her last name is spelled G-A-J-D-A, pronounced Gaida.
Thank you, David.
And you can also hear her legal commentaries on this station once a week and also read them in the News Gazette newspaper. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here, Amy.